from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Joy Powers. Today we'll learn about the King Center on Milwaukee's Near North Side. Then we'll explore a national audit of monuments across the U.S., which found they tell a skewed version of history.
The monument landscape is overwhelmingly white and male. The most common features of American monuments reflect war and conquest, and the story of the United States as told by our current monuments misrepresents our history.
Plus, we'll learn about a unique World War II era program that put family pets on the front lines.
They really reached out to folks on the home front, including children, and this included them asking for family pets to be donated to service in the war.
All of that is coming up on Lake Effect. But first, here are today's headlines. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Joy Powers, and thank you so much for joining us. The King Center has been serving the Near North Side of Milwaukee for over 45 years. Over time, it's been home to countless summer camps, youth programs, and community groups. The park even once featured a roller rink, outdoor theater, and sports courts and fields of all kinds. But a few months ago, with the police shooting of Sam Sharp Jr. right in front of the building, the story of the center and the neighborhood changed in an instant. A center that brought people together was now portrayed as a place to avoid at all costs. But for the people who really know this place, they know that's not the full story. Lake Effect's Jimmy Gutierrez shares this portrait of the King Center.
When I was a kid, and then this was my favorite room in the building. It's all crazy in there now, but...
Yeah, they're doing a whole bunch of renovations
in
there.
Yeah, that was Miss Ramona's room. That was the art room, and I spent so much of my time in there.
214?
Yep, that was my favorite space.
This is Symphony Swan Zawadi, and we are at the King Center on the Near North Side. Symphony used to come here just about every summer growing up.
I don't know if we got into what you do today, but...
Yeah, so today I'm literally an artist, a practicing artist, so it makes sense. I work for a National Arts Foundation, and I've been an art teacher. I've been a community artist. It is in my blood, and I had opportunities here at the King Center to express that and explore that.
All right, so Symphony might be humble, but I'm going to speak for her, and I do not have to be. She is one of one in Milwaukee. Last year, Shepherd Express named her Milwaukeean of the Year. She's won grant funding for her art. She has started and led arts organization in the city. And she says that none of that happens without the King Center, the place Mr. Holmes pushed her to compete in track, where she eventually became a city conference champ. It's where she hooped with the boys. A place where even when she was home, she always begged to go back.
Like, can we go to the King Center? You know, you had your little summertime crushes, you had your friends, you know. And that was just, it felt like family every time we were here.
No community center is just its building. Not the good ones anyways. But the King Center, it's a part of Milwaukee's history. A part of the fabric of the story of our city, and particularly Black Milwaukee. But after Columbus police murdered Sam Sharp Jr., the center and the neighborhood have been portrayed locally and nationally as a place of homelessness, despair, and trauma. And listen, these are issues, but it's not the story. And it's not the story the people at the center would tell.
We are being remodeled. We're getting a brand new roof, getting a lot of knockouts of some walls to enlarge the rooms and eliminate some overhangs. I am Dee McCullum, the director of the Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Community Center.
Dee McCullum, or just Ms. Dee, as everyone calls her, says the renovations are long overdue. She painted the whole main floor in a high-gloss white with black trim, saying that she wants it to look bright, just how she hopes people feel when they come inside.
How are you thinking about the space and community specifically and bringing people into the space?
One of the things that I do on purpose is when we have our 4th of July celebration, our Thanksgiving celebration, and our Christmas celebration, I on purpose give them the programming information for what's going on in the King Center every day. And what I've noticed over the years, what happens from that is a lot of those people have never been here before. They just come for the Christmas celebration or the Thanksgiving. But now I've given them some information about what we do the other 364 days of the year. And we now have those people funneling back into the building.
Ms. D says there are rooms to rent for events like birthday parties, corporate events, or luncheons. They also house a bunch of community partners like Fathers Making Progress and Summit, which works in youth programming. There's a new partner that'll help folks transition from foster care. There's the basketball court, which stays full, a legendary boxing gym and karate program, and a basketball literacy program soon to start, led by Milwaukee's own Mike Taylor. Yeah, the same one who put up 35 against the Knicks at Madison Square Garden.
He is quick, kicking up his heels. Taylor to the basket, left hand up and in.
But even with all the renovations happening around here, people are still coming in. And that includes to use the full circuit gym downstairs. Think Planet Fitness, but without the purple. And that's where Enrique was working out his delts and traps.
I waited until the ripe age of 60 to start bodybuilding. And I'm focusing on creating the image I have within, making it real. I just have a lot of history here. I started coming here when I was a kid. I must have been about 11 or 12. I played pool. I used to practice piano in one of the rooms. Back in the day, there was Mr. Pitts was the director, and I would come and I would do arts and crafts. And it was just, you know, this was the place to be.
If you're from Milwaukee, you might not have heard of this gym, but you probably heard of the other one here, the legendary Al Moreland's Boxing Gym. The gym here isn't too big. There's a ring that's got a few elementary age kids in it right now swinging wildly. There are a few heavy bags and lockers lining the room. And in the back, there's a smaller space with some free weights and treadmills. And it may look modest, but this is where some of Milwaukee's baddest champs have come from.
So I'm doing a little story on the King Center and just like what this place means to the community, to folks. Obviously, having a boxing program here.
You want to go up in the office right quick? In a little area.
This is Ernie Haynes. His mirrored lens glasses say he's no nonsense. Probably why he's the center's lead boxing trainer. And it's a position he took over after the late Al Moreland's brother Tom called him after COVID lockdown.
He says, Ernie, can you carry on? And I told him it'd be my honor to carry on the Moreland legacy and to bring in the team certified legacy and, you know, my legacy as well.
Ernie has trained professional boxers. He loves training pro fighters. But his calling was to train kids, specifically kids being bullied. He's talked about this with his own son being bullied. And after a while, it was just time to teach him how to defend himself. And now this is something he does for all kids.
This is where my wealth lies. Wealth has nothing to do with the money. It has everything to do with what you leave behind, your legacy. So that's where I'm at right now.
All right, we can't leave the King Center without talking about the other gym, the one where the Hoopers live.
My name is Charles Dupree. I've been a member of the King Center for the time it opened. There were great players coming through here, like Marquette. They had Marquette players. They had some of the Bucks. A lot of great pickup games.
Was there a trash talking, or was it like friendly, kind of like, I don't know what friendly looks like there.
Of course, there's always trash talking. That's what makes the game so competitive.
Were you more of a trash talker, or were you more of like a silent killer?
Pretty more like a silent killer. I just kind of let the game speak for itself.
More than a building, it's also more than its programming. The King Center, by proximity, is also a place for a lot of the city's unsheltered population, at least in the park. Ms. D says they used to open up the center for some of the guys to shower, but there were real safety concerns with some of the untreated mental health issues. She says she'll still open up the center at times, but only when there are no kids present. She wasn't always like this, she says. Certain events have changed her, softened her. Like one winter morning, she's coming into work, and she sees a man behind the building.
He had his little blanket and stuff. He was laying on the vent, and so I went over to him. I was like, you know, you really can't lay there. And he knew my name. So he was like, well, Ms. D, this is the safest place for me to be because it's the warmest place. And I ended up sitting down, striking up a conversation with him. And during that conversation, I found out he had a college degree. And he was extremely intelligent. He just had the mental health issues. And even during the conversation, I could see the issues he had, but they did not supersede the intelligent conversation that I had with this man. And by the time I finished, I let him in the building. There was nobody else here. But by the time he left me that morning and stuff, I didn't even work the rest of the day. I was so emotional, and I'm trying not to get the way again, but I was so emotional, taken back, because we all have prejudgments of people. You know, we assume that because somebody is homeless, they're uneducated, or they don't want to do better, or they chose to be in that position that they're in.
A lot of people jumped to prejudgments a few months ago when 5 Columbus police shot and killed Samuel Sharp Jr. Ms. D knew Sam and his loyal dog, Isis. And she says he was nothing like he was portrayed.
He was a different kind of man because he was like a gentle warrior. He, too, you could see some of the issues that he was having, but he was always talking about the better man. He would not talk about what he was experiencing that day or that he lived in a tent. He never talked about any things. He always talked about the betterment of men. And I was just like, that is the last thing that would be on a person's mind that has a house and a shower and stuff. But he always talked about what we could do to better men.
The King Center, it is the heartbeat of the community. Anything that's needed, even if families come in here indigent, you know, there is a program here that will help them or refer them to someone that can help them immediately.
It's true. There are wraparound services for so many different people in situations here. But I also heard about how things have changed, how kids don't show up like they used to, how the park used to be, more sports teams, more staff, more kids playing outside. Symphony said it's not that the neighborhood changed, although it has, but it's the center.
And when you know this area, oh, the kids are here, they just don't feel the same agency and ownership of this place that maybe like my generation did.
What do you think has changed?
It is an all-around systems failure that we are experiencing across the city.
By systems failure, she means parents are working harder than ever to provide, and some people are just trying to survive. And funding from state and local budgets has also slowed. Do more with less is the motto we've heard.
The communities that have the less crime are the ones that have the most resources. And when we begin to consider the dignity of Black folks in this city, then we won't have to fight to eliminate food deserts.
Or struggle to provide safe and affordable housing, or properly fund our schools and community centers.
There are always these conversations about Kia boys and violence and this uptick and da 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 da. And it's like, we're not making any investments. There's an African proverb that says, young people will burn the village down in order to feel its warmth. Because we are not being intentional about creating spaces and opportunities and just wrapping our arms around the young people, the oppressed people, you get what you get.
My heart struggles because if we were not here or we stopped doing the things that we do, I'm not saying that people couldn't get it elsewhere, but it would be more of a struggle for them to get the things that they get from the King Center. I'm 67, I'm ready to not do anything, but I can't because I always think about Sam Sharp. I always think about that young man on my vent. I always think about that boy who died on my floor. I always think about the least man that we're supposed to be thinking of. And if I can't be assured that somebody's gonna pick up that ball, then I'm gonna keep doing it.
That piece was produced by Lake Effect's Jimmy Gutierrez. He spoke with Symphony Swan Zawadi, Dee McCollum, Ernie Haynes, Charles Dupree, and David Powell. On Election Day, November 5th, voters across Wisconsin will weigh in on a proposed amendment to the state constitution. It'll appear as a question on their ballots, and it's related to voting. The proposal would add language to Wisconsin's constitution that says only U.S. citizens over the age of 18 can vote in federal, state, local, or school elections. Anthony Chergosky spoke with WUWM's Lena Tran to break down the ballot measure. Chergosky is an assistant professor of political science at UW La Crosse.
So just to start, you know, Wisconsin voters have seen some different questions on our ballots in the past few years. What is this question doing on my ballot?
Yeah, so if we consider the process through which a constitutional amendment gets on the Wisconsin ballot, it really requires two stages. The first stage is approval by the Wisconsin state legislature. Now, that is a little different than the typical lawmaking process. The first difference is that a proposed constitutional amendment needs to be voted on twice. It needs to be voted on in two consecutive sessions of the Wisconsin state legislature. It needs to be approved by a majority vote in both the Senate and the Assembly, and it is not subject to the veto of the governor. So some real differences there, because for a typical law, it only needs to be passed once, and it is subject to the veto of the governor. So that's the first stage, the approval of the proposed amendment by the Wisconsin state legislature. The second stage is approval by the voters. So voters will go to the ballot in November, they'll go to the ballot box or they'll vote absentee, and they will see the latest proposed Wisconsin constitutional amendment on their ballot. And we have seen Republicans put forth a number of proposed constitutional amendments since Tony Evers was elected governor in 2018 for exactly the reason that I mentioned earlier. The governor cannot veto proposed constitutional amendments. The governor cannot prevent proposed constitutional amendments from making their way to the ballot. So in a time of divided control of government with a Democratic governor and Republican majorities in the Wisconsin state legislature, we have seen a real uptick in Republicans using the constitutional amendment route as a way to circumvent the veto pen of Governor Evers.
Mm-hmm. And this November in particular, voters will see a question related to voting and non-citizens. What is this question all about?
Yeah, it says that only citizens aged 18 or older and those who are a resident of Wisconsin may vote in national, state, or local elections. Now, this is already true in Wisconsin. It is already true that only citizens may vote. But Republicans argue that this amendment is necessary to head off potential efforts by local governments to enable non-citizens to vote in local elections, for example, school board elections. Republicans point to examples around the nation of local governments aiming to open the way for non-citizens to vote. So this, I mean, it's nothing new that non-citizens would not be allowed to vote in federal or state elections, and there are not any cases in Wisconsin in which non-citizens would be able to vote in local elections. But Republicans argue that this is necessary as a preventative measure to discourage local governments from even going down that route.
Mm-hmm. So a yes vote in this case means, yes, I want this added to the Constitution, and a no vote means, no, I do not want this added.
Yep, a no vote would mean maintain the status quo, and a yes vote would mean adding this element of the Constitution saying that only citizens may vote in federal, state, and local elections.
So it sounds like nothing would change practically if this passed. How often does this actually happen, you know, for Republicans to have these concerns about non-citizens trying to vote in Wisconsin?
Yeah, so Democrats have accused Republicans of playing into conspiracy theories and playing into doubts about elections. And we know that this occurs in a context in which the Republican Party has focused on issues of elections, certainly in the aftermath of the 2020 election. So you're absolutely right. Practically speaking, this would not change anything in Wisconsin should this amendment be approved. But again, Republicans argue that this is part of a broader effort to secure the integrity of elections. They argue that this is part of a broader effort to ensure that only people who they say, you know, the only people who are citizens can vote in elections. But as noted, Democrats claim that Republicans are fanning the flames of election-related conspiracy theories as they put this proposal on the November ballot.
Mm-hmm. I guess also the national context, it's hard to untangle this from the backdrop of, you know, immigration and the border being a huge issue in this year's presidential election. Do you feel like that's also a part of the conversation here?
Yeah, to me, this constitutional amendment is much more interesting regarding what it says about the broader political context than any practical effect or any concrete way that this amendment would change the conduct of Wisconsin elections. And I think you noted a very important piece of the context, which is the context surrounding immigration. And we've already talked about that other piece of context surrounding the way Republicans view elections and the way that Republicans talk about what they often call election integrity. So I think the context here matters more than any tangible outcome of this amendment vote might matter. And Republicans have said that they want to continue using constitutional amendments in Wisconsin, in spite of the fact that they experienced a setback in the August election, where two of their proposed constitutional amendments were voted down in the August primary. In spite of that setback for Republicans, Assembly Speaker Robin Voss said that the Republican Party should double down on constitutional amendments and continue using them. And so that'll be very interesting to watch. Of course, a lot of this hinges on the outcome of the November elections, because if Republicans lose majority control of the state assembly, then they will lose the opportunity to propose and advance constitutional amendments. So Republican leaders, including Speaker Voss, say that they want to push forward on putting more constitutional amendments on the ballot. They want to push forward on efforts like the one we're seeing this November. But that effort, their goal of continuing to use constitutional amendments, will hinge on the outcome of the November 2024 elections and the balance of power in the state assembly.
Sure, sure. Do other states have language like this in their constitutions, or is Wisconsin alone in this respect?
We have seen a number of states move in this direction because of that broader political context that we've been talking about. So Wisconsin is not alone in the type of issue that we're seeing on the ballot in November for the constitutional amendment. It's very much part of a broader political movement, particularly inside the Republican Party.
Mm-hmm. And we've talked a little bit about, you know, Republicans' interest in advancing these constitutional amendments. Can you talk about who is against this and who's been vocal against this referendum?
Yeah, we have seen Democratic leaders speak out against the proposed constitutional amendment on citizenship and voting, basically saying that this is unnecessary, that it stigmatizes people, and that it feeds into conspiracy theories about elections. So for Democrats, it seems like they're opposition to this amendment isn't so much based on the substance of the amendment as it is their critique of the Republican political strategy behind the amendment.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Cool. Is there anything else that you would like to mention?
Yeah, I am deeply skeptical that this will drive voter turnout or at all affect the outcome of the November election. I do think the constitutional amendments on the August ballot did drive voter turnout. They did drive voter engagement, and they did so in a way that really advantaged the Democratic Party's side of the constitutional amendment debate that we had over the summer surrounding the amendments related to Governor Evers' power to direct certain types of federal dollars. Now, those amendments drove the political dialogue for the August primary because there simply wasn't much else on the August primary ballot. And in fact, the constitutional amendments in August were the only thing on the statewide ballot. So The difference between the August primary and the November election is night and day. Wisconsin remains pivotal in the presidential election. There is a competitive U.S. Senate race. There are competitive U.S. House of Representatives races in certain parts of the state. And as we noted, there is a vigorous battle for majority control of the state assembly. It's hard for me to see how there's going to be much attention paid to the proposed constitutional amendment in November, given everything else that's on the ballot. For the August primary, Democrats were able to get their message across because there wasn't so much clutter, if you will, in the political environment. But there's going to be so many things voters are going to be asked to pay attention to in the November election that I just can't imagine that voters are going to pay much attention to the proposed constitutional amendment. And that means that voters are going to have to rely on the text that they see on the ballot. If they don't know a lot about this issue going into their November ballot, voting in person or absentee, if they don't know a lot about this constitutional amendment question in advance, then they're really going to have to lean on the text on the ballot. And in Wisconsin, that text can be highly technical. It can be difficult for people to understand. So I think that's what I'm watching as we head towards the November election.
Yeah, lots to look forward to this November.
Absolutely.
Thank you so much, Anthony. I really appreciate you taking the time.
Oh, my pleasure, Lena. Great to talk with you again.
That was Anthony Chergosky, an assistant professor of political science at UW-La Crosse. He spoke with WUWM's Lena Tran about the constitutional amendment on the November 5th ballot. During World War II, everyday citizens were asked to sacrifice a lot. In some cases, that included their family pets. Later in the show, we'll learn about the War Dog Program and a Wisconsin pup who was deployed to the Pacific Theater. But first, we'll begin a new series about representation in public art called Reflections of Representation. That's coming up next on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. You're listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. This week, WUWM Eric Vaughn fellow Nadia Kelly is exploring who is and isn't honored in public art like monuments and murals. Her series is called Reflections of Representation. Nadia spoke with Paul Farber, director of the Monument Lab in Philadelphia. In 2021, Farber's organization conducted an audit of statues and monuments throughout the U.S. He explains what the audit found and why it's important.
You know, there had never been an audit of America's monument landscape. Thanks to the Mellon Foundation, Monument Lab worked in partnership to produce the first ever audit. It was not going to be a list of everything that could ever be called a monument or not. That would be an impossible task. But what we did do is we gathered a study set of monument data from federal, state, local, tribal, institutional, and public sources, put all of that data together to create a study set of close to 50,000 conventional monuments across every US state, territory, numerous tribal nations and communities, as a way to understand not just in one city or one town or one moment in time, but across the country, across generations, who have we as an American culture venerated and uplifted? And what we found really blew us away. Our key findings were that the monument landscape is overwhelmingly white and male. The most common features of American monuments reflect war and conquest. And the story of the United States as told by our current monuments misrepresents our history. I'll give you a sense that we looked at the top 50 figures who have monuments dedicated to them in this country as of our publication date in 2021. There were more Confederates than Black Americans in that top 50. The most monumentalized woman, Joan of Arc. And of those top 50 figures, only three of them were women. And of those women, you have Joan of Arc, Harriet Tubman, and Sacagawea. There were no U.S.-born Latinx, Asian Pacific Islander, or self-identified LGBTQ plus people. Half of that top 50 claimed ownership over other human beings. So you get a sense of not just, okay, what are monuments doing in my city or town, but you're looking at this across the country, across generations. And I think that it was really important for us to understand that for every new monument that comes up that tells an underrepresented or under-spotlighted story, or a toxic one that is removed and, you know, pulled into a cemetery or into public storage or rethought, that we're actually contending with a monument landscape that has largely only told us a sliver of the story. And we have often kind of lost sight of the fact that history doesn't live inside of a statue. It lives with people. It lives in organizations. It lives in institutions. It lives in neighborhoods. And so I think that for us, that audit and other conversations and work across this country has reminded us that, again, that history is not just living on top of a pedestal. It lives with people. And it's important to invest in those people telling the fullest history possible, so we have great guidance on not just where we've been, but where we're going.
Along the lines of how, like, our current monument landscape, you know, may not tell the entire story of, you know, the people that live across this country, how does creating a monument to a historical figure affect the way we remember them?
Yeah, I love that question. And memory is a part of that. But I would argue that actually the primary function of a monument is about power. So I think when we're thinking about memory, there are monuments, there are statues, there are public sculptures that do the work of memorialization and memory. But there are also historical societies and sororities and newspapers and schools that also do it. They just might dedicate a bench, or they might hold an anniversary day, or they might put forth a book or an archive. And so I think in this case, like, it's a both and. I want us to understand the kind of work that happens through a monument that may be in the service of memory, may help us speak out the name or names of people who have made impact, and to understand that it's not a be-all, end-all when it comes to the structure. We're also really thinking about what kind of activities go around that from the moment of it being conceptualized to the moments that it lives in this world, that memory is something that is happening in very conscious and subconscious ways, and that every community has its own pathway to memorialization that's worth knowing and appreciating.
Mm-hmm. That is so interesting. I love this distinction you make, because there's so many ways we can memorialize something, but with monuments it's something, you know, more than just sort of dedicating to something to the memory of, especially like when we start to get into the conversation of like what, like which types of people are not represented, and thinking about power, certain historical figures don't have that same access to being memorialized and or being having, I guess, that power attached to their presence. While I'm on this train of thought, could you give me an idea of how rare it is for a historical figure who belongs to a marginalized population to be recognized in the form of a monument?
Yeah, I think it is important to put it in a context that we're not operating from neutral ground. We're operating from a profound inequity of historic representation. So, in our audit, and I'll say this again, but our National Monument audit with the Mellon Foundation, we looked at the top 50 figures who have monuments built to them in this country, across space, across time, across generations. And of that list, 11 of the top 50 were U.S. presidents, 12 were U.S. generals. Note, we didn't count someone if they only fought for the Confederacy. That wasn't a general for the U.S. They were fighting to end the U.S. 76% of that top 50 were landowners, and 40% were born into wealth. Half of that top 50 were enslavers, claimed ownership over other people. in that top 50, there are more Confederates than Black Americans. And so we're looking at how the monument landscape has evolved over the last several years. We will see more symbols dedicated to people of the global majority. We will see more that expand our sense of who gets monumentalized. But the fact remains that we've largely kept and inherited a monument landscape that's gone uninterrupted, that disproportionately elevates those who've had multiple forms of power, whether it's land ownership, whether it's wealth, whether it's access to the presidency, and of course, race and gender and sexuality are all part of that.
So I think, okay, so like a few years ago, you know, there was a big movement with people sort of looking at like, you know, Confederate monuments, a lot of different monuments, but a lot of this attention was focused on like Confederate monuments. There was like a big toppling movement that happened like across the nation. And now we're like a few years like after that. What do you think the impact of that reckoning like with, you know, are the statues that we have in this country? Like, what do you think the impacts of that has been?
Yeah, I appreciate that question because I do think there have been material changes and opening new possibilities. But I also think that the reckoning is worth taking a look at and understanding. And I bring it back all down to values. Like, what do you want to be remembered for? What do we want to be remembered for? I think there's one kind of really interesting fact that came out of our audit, because we get a lot of questions about monument takedowns. And what we found is that in the years 2020 and 2021, over 99% of monuments were not taken down and torn down. That means that the large majority of monuments stayed as is. Of the monuments that came down, again, under 1% of the monument landscape. We're also talking about structures that were not that were taken down in the process undergone by a municipality that may have taken years, maybe have taken decades to re-examine and reassess. So I think it's important to note, one, that the reckoning did not actually disrupt the entirety of the monument landscape. It really was focused in on places and people that had been really under a microscope for some time. In most cases.
In your work with the National Monument Audit, for Wisconsin specifically, like, were you able to see like what kinds of monuments we have here, or what kind of monuments like we don't tend to see here in the state?
Yeah, I actually want to answer this in a way of calling to attention a local figure who's making national headlines, and that is the late Vel Phillips, who is getting her kind of just due in a few different places in her home state as a politician, an attorney, a civil rights activist, that both around the state capitol and then also in the city of Milwaukee. You have a statue at the Capitol in Madison that was recently dedicated, and you have another that will be dedicated in the next several years. You don't just get a monument kind of automatically. People have to fight for it. Mm-hmm. Your family, your friends, those who come after you. And so I think it's also a celebration of the constituencies who've said, here is a moment to highlight someone who may have been a monumental figure in their own communities, but now can be seen, registered, and appreciated more broadly. So I think of that as a really important story coming out of your local landscape that is making kind of ripples and waves more broadly. And it allows people, no matter where they are, to think about, well, if Vel Phillips is being elevated, how do I learn more about her story? And who is a Vel Phillips of my community? Mm-hmm. Part of the process of memorialization is not just about inscribing someone's name in stone or steel in public. It's about saying their name. It's about understanding their values. It's about reiterating and finding bonds across generations. And so I think with these two statues and probably the other kind of memorializations and commemorations that will go around both their creation and their perpetuation, I think a lot more possibility will come out from those. That's really exciting to see.
That was Paul Farber, director of the nonprofit Monument Lab, speaking with WUWM Eric Vaughn Fellow Nadia Kelly. Nadia's series, Reflections of Representation, continues this week, looking at solutions to help public art tell a fuller story of our history and communities. Coming up, we'll learn about a Wisconsin pet turned World War II veteran and a new children's book all about his life. That's next on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. This is Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. During World War II, American families were asked to make a lot of sacrifices. Americans rationed everything from food and clothing to gas and firewood. Some families were even asked to donate their pets to the war effort for the Dogs for Defense program. The military deployed family pets to the front lines to help soldiers on the battlefield. That included a little dog named Brownie from King, Wisconsin. His life story is now the subject of a children's book called Brownie the War Dog, written by Kelly Nelson. She joins me now to talk about it and the history of war dogs. Kelly, thank you so much for being here on Lake Effect.
Oh, you're welcome. I'm happy to be here. I appreciate the invitation.
One of the most fascinating things about this book is this little-known program it discusses, where Americans were encouraged to enlist their pets. Can you tell us a bit about it?
I'd be glad to. So the Dogs for Defense program was very unique. It was a civilian-based program that was started by dog enthusiasts. And they started to think that maybe that there was a skill set with dogs, and especially in the obedience world and things that they thought might marry well with the military and what they could use the dogs for as far as war use. So it was a very unique time. And they really reached out to folks on the home front, including children. And this included them asking for family pets to be donated to service in the war. And there were regional recruiters. There was one in Milwaukee that we know of. And at that time, this was new. This was a new use for World War II. So they relied on recruiting the family pets.
Now, I was a bit familiar with the Army and the Navy using cats, you know, for pest control and that kind of thing on ships and in storage facilities, but I was less aware of exactly what dogs were being enlisted to do. What were the kinds of jobs that a dog would perform during the war?
Sure. So there was a variety of tasks that they had really enlisted them for. Many were sentry dogs, which Brownie was a sentry dog, basically a guard dog. And it was guarding artillery. It was guarding the men. A handler was assigned, and that individual handler exclusively handled the war dog. And it was not a pet anymore. It was trained to be an attack dog. And even the other soldiers didn't get close. It was something that was, it was a tool. And it was a tool that was very much used for protection. Other dogs that were more like a husky and those kind of breeds, Malamutes, they were used for pulling sleds in different regions. Some dogs were used as messenger dogs to relay messages to soldiers. So a variety of uses. And they did have to have specific height requirements, weight requirements. These were not jobs that were suited for small dogs. They had to have some girth to them.
Do we know about how many dogs ended up serving in World War II for the U.S. Army?
The U.S. Military in general had asked for about 200,000. That was what their goal was. They wanted purebreds. But at that time in our country, there were not a lot of purebreds. And so they had to widen their net as far as reaching out to crossbreeds and things, shepherd mixes, Dobermans, but about 20,000 dogs were donated, with about 10,000 of those making the cut. Many of the dogs were afraid of noises, and that seemed to be the biggest problem, that the dogs were put in situations where they just shut down because of the noises. So they became very particular as far as who they approved to be in the War Dog program, and much of it was based, again, on the size, but also their ability to withstand the noises.
Sure. A lot of noise during war, I would imagine, and a lot of different requirements as far as temperament, as far as ability to do the job, as you say. What made a dog like Brownie a good candidate for the war?
I think really the trainability, the youth, they had to be young dogs, they had to be trainable. The main thing being that they had to be quiet. Even in, if you follow any dog obedience, as you get into the upper ranks, a lot of the dog training is done with hand signals. And these dogs had to learn to be quiet. These dogs really had to learn to watch their handlers because everything was given with either hand signals or by body language. And they had to learn to be very quiet. So really, I think just the willingness and trainability was the main thing as far as the success of the dogs.
So for Brownie, what was that journey like from being a house pet into being on the front lines with all of the other soldiers?
Right. So he was sent from Waupaca, Wisconsin. He was sent to the Fort Robinson Dog Receiving and Training Center out in Nebraska. And that's where veterinarians, they did, you know, they had an initial physical to make sure he passed physical requirements. And then that's when intense training started. And a big part of that was assigning a handler, having that handler be the exclusive person to feed him, groom him, train him. And it was a very intense training process that they needed to go through. And again, much of it being for the dog to learn to be quiet and really follow and watch his handler so that they were ready to be shipped over to the Pacific Theater, in Brownie's case, in order to do the job to keep his handler safe and his unit safe.
Now, once he was out there, what was Brownie doing?
So he was a sentry dog. So he, a variety of tasks. It was really to be a protector for his handler, for his unit. In any capacity, he was always being asked to sniff out the enemy. And these were in very, very intense circumstances. The Pacific Theater really refers to the islands. There was a lot of battling that was going on where they had to hop from island to island. And this also included the monsoon season in more of the spring and June time of the year. And Brownie was there for about a year and a half, so he would have withstood this, where it just rained constantly. And these were jungles, so just really awful conditions. Sometimes it was shoulder deep in water that the dogs had to wade through, so really, really miserable circumstances. But he did his job, and he did it well.
Now, of course, World War II had many casualties, and I was surprised to learn that a little dog like Brownie was able to survive the war. He came back, but like many veterans, he had changed quite a bit. How did Brownie live out the rest of his days after the war?
Sure. So after the war, he did go through a demilitarization process. He went back to the Fort Robinson Training Center, and they basically civilianized these dogs so that they would be able to function within just regular civilian circumstances. He was sent back to his family. Families did have the option of bringing the dog home to them, and they had to accept them no matter what the circumstance was. But Brownie had a wonderful temperament. He switched right back. He made the transition back from a fierce fighting sentry dog to that of a family dog. And he began to follow Orin, his young owner's mother, who was a cook at the home at the Wisconsin Veterans Home at King. She was a cook there. And he began to accompany her. He'd escort her to work every day. And then when she went in, then he'd make his rounds and visited all the veterans and really became quite beloved by the veterans and their families. And everyone was devastated when he was hit by a car and killed. But he did live out the remainder of his years really in service to man in just a different fashion. He served while he was overseas, and he served man when he came back. So I think when I learned of his story, I just thought it was the most endearing thing, that this animal just really his whole life was in service to people.
For sure. Now, of course, this is a fairly serious topic, and the book is for kids. What do you hope kids get from reading this?
I hope that they have a real understanding of the sacrifices that were made on the home front during World War II from the families, from the children. I hope that they also had a real appreciation for this canine hero who is from Wisconsin, who was buried here 75 years ago. 2024 marks the 75th anniversary of his passing and military funeral. But it pleased me just so much that the Wisconsin Historical Society Press, who published this book, felt the same way that I did, as far as that his story deserved to be preserved and shared in this fashion and in such a beautiful picture book format. So there are just so many things that I hope that children take away from this, but mostly just to have that appreciation of the sacrifice that was made.
Well, Kelly, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect and sharing your work.
Thank you for having me.
Kelly Nelson is the author of Brownie the War Dog. And that wraps up today's show. Thank you so much for being here with us. I'm Joy Powers. If you missed any of today's conversations, or if you'd like to take Lake Effect on the go, download our podcast. Search for Lake Effect wherever you get your podcasts to listen to all of our shows on demand. Tomorrow on Lake Effect, we'll hear about the push in Wisconsin to introduce instant runoff voting, where voters rank multiple candidates. Plus, we'll have the latest episode of our Live at Lake Effect series, featuring classical guitarist Rene Izquierdo. That's tomorrow at noon, right here on Lake Effect, on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.